All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Nicks? What's happening? How are you? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. This is it. This is what I do. This and a few other things. How you guys adjusting to authoritarianism? How's that going for you? At some point, the despair and hopelessness and anger gives way to something, and some sort of adaptation. You can fight the fight as long as you want. Boycott the Tesla, boycott the Amazon, make a sign, get out there and protest with a sign that says, please just stop. This is fucking crazy. You know, bold letter crazy, bold letter stop. So much coming at us at all times. Hard to be specific. All of it bad. Please just stop. This is fucking crazy. And vote. And get behind people that you think can maybe surface in the future. But how are you adapting to authoritarianism? It's interesting with tragedy, isn't it? COVID, climate change is eventually, you know, people are, yeah, a few days go by, a few months go by, and they're like, well, I guess I'm relatively okay. And then you think about friends or family or people that aren't, and then you kind of feel bad and you want to help them out or try to change something. Please just stop. This is fucking crazy. That ought to do it. That ought to fucking do it. God damn it. It's just going to be awful for the rest of time. You got to find some sanity. Find some fucking sanity. Try to do the right thing by you and yours and get behind the right things and, you know, make those signs. Please. Just fucking stop. This is fucking crazy. I had a fucking, there's two fuckings in there now. It's a bigger sign. So look, today on the show, I'm talking to Lynn Margulies. She's an artist and the co-director of the 1989 documentary, I'm From Hollywood. And that film was about her late boyfriend, Andy Kaufman, and his foray into wrestling. Now, there's this new doc about Andy out. And she's part of it. The documentary is called Thank You Very Much, directed by Alex Braverman. It's been in the works a while. And I don't care if you're an Andy fan or not. You got to know about Kaufman. You got to know about him. I mean, you know, he was a challenging, one-of-a-kind, comedic supernova of a certain ilk. He's the only one. There's only one Andy Kaufman. And he has influenced a lot of people. I mean, really, in terms of real punk rock comedy, real comedy that bends reality into something that you don't really know what is happening or understand why it's happening, and you're forced into this time zone of laughing, discomfort, sometimes repulsion, sometimes anger. Any zone of reaction was fine with Andy as long as it was focused on him and what he was doing. I mean, some of it is relentlessly uncomfortable. And for me, I don't know that I was a fan early on. I am a more kind of real guy. You know, I'm not a huge fan of absurdism or bending reality or challenging in the way that he did. I just like, you know, people to put their heart on the line. And I don't know that maybe he thought he did that. I don't know that. It doesn't seem like he did. It was more of a provocateur kind of thing, but it wasn't my bag. But I did cultivate an appreciation for Andy as years went by. And there's some things that he did as I get older that I appreciate even more. And I missed a lot of it. I feel like I did. But his Carnegie Hall concert was spectacular. There's a bit in there that is one of the best things I've ever seen in my life. I talked to Lynn a bit about that. But there is something about this doc. And we've talked to a lot of people on this show about Andy, people who worked with Andy. And we've got a pretty good catalog of just people talking about Andy on this show, which is pretty comprehensive. But this documentary did something that I think has never really been done. It humanizes Andy in a way that hasn't been explored, you know, making connections in his childhood and in his life through events pre his performing years that could somehow put him more into perspective, explain some elements of his personality, which was hard to really kind of nail down because he was moving through so many. And whoever the real Andy Kaufman was, who knows who their real self is, really. But he kind of played a lot with that. But this doc really tries to get at that. And I didn't know where the conversation with Lynn would go. But, you know, we got some places about him and about the arc of what he was going through and how he seemingly sabotaged his career and his relationships in the name of his expression. I don't think he ever considered himself a performance artist or an artist necessarily, but he was someone who had to do what he was doing. Thank God he did, because God knows what he would have been had he not done that. But the documentary is totally worth watching. It's called Thank You Very Much, and I believe it's available. It's now playing in theaters, and it's available to watch on digital on-demand platforms. You can go to thankyouverymuch.drafthousefilms.com for more details, but it's a pretty great portrait and biography of one of the great American artists of comedy, certainly. And in the doc, they even got, you know, Bob Zmuda to talk like a person and really just reflect on his friendship with Andy, as opposed to continue mythologizing him and insinuating that he's still alive or what have you. And they talked to a lot of people who worked with him and people who had thoughts about him. It's a pretty solid doc, and I was happy I saw it. I'll be in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I'm coming to GLC Live at 20 Monroe on Friday, April 11th. And then Traverse City, Michigan, I'll be at the City Opera House on Saturday, April 12th. In Los Angeles, I'm at Dynasty Typewriter Monday, April 14th, Saturday, April 26th, and Tuesday, April 29th. Those are all at 7:30 p.m. Largo in L.A., I've got an 8 p.m. show on Tuesday, April 22nd. Then I'm coming to Toronto, Vermont, New Hampshire, and then Brooklyn for my HBO special taping at the BAM Harvey Theater on May 10th. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all my dates and links to tickets. If you want to get in on that HBO taping, I would get in on it. I think that the tickets are moving pretty quickly, and there's not a ton left. In other news, let's get mundane. Let's get to the minutia. Let's get to what's happening in my immediate world. I'm finally back for a few days, and as I've talked about before, the problem with Charlie, the problem with Charlie. Charlie is my youngest cat. Charlie is an asshole. He's a spoiled brat, and he's a troublemaker. But on another level, when I leave town, he goes through profound stress that causes him to lash out at the other cats, causes him to vomit, causes him to shit all over the house, diarrhea, with stress-induced colitis. And it's a problem. It's not a fun thing to come home to. And once he was diagnosed with this stress-induced separation anxiety thing that manifests in all these different ways, the vet, and I've talked about this before, but you know we've moved forward a bit here. The vet prescribed Fluoxetine. Is that what it is? Fluoxetine, Prozac for the cat. And as I mentioned before, I projected my own issues with me taking Prozac onto the cat, and it's an ongoing conversation. And I'm on medicine now, too, for the first time in many years with some confidence in it. But I just I really was concerned about Charlie's personality. I didn't want to mess with his assholeness. Now, look, when you have a cat, it's an odd relationship because they're all kind of crazy and they all go through periods of insanity that destroys your house one way or the other. Whether it's, oh, he's peeing too outside the box when he gets stressed. You know, whether it's pee or vomit or destruction of furniture or, you know, when they get old, you know, whether or not, you know, how long to extend their lives with fluids. And, you know, there's all kinds of different phases and their personalities change over time. I've had a lot of cats. I know this. But there's something about the assholes that the longer they stay an asshole, the more, if you're like me, who's kind of a stubborn, asshole-ish person at times. I like that. I like it to a point. You still get mad, but that's part of the dynamic, is being able to go, oh, fuck, Charlie, why'd you do this? Why is that a good thing? I don't know. But I decided, since I do have a little travel coming up, and maybe I didn't want to deal with all that nonsense, that I'd go ahead and do the Prozac. And that means you have to administer medicine to a fucking cat. And for some reason, no matter how far pet medicine comes, there's no easy way or a delivery system to give cats fucking medicine. You can't give cats pills. Maybe some people can, but I've never had a cat that I could give a pill to effectively, unless I mash it up and mash it into chicken. And when I was treating monkey for the hypertension. But there's just no fucking way, and they hate you. You know, you're squirting stuff in their mouth, and they hate you for a little while. And I take it personally. I anthropomorphize too much. But, like, I've gotten, I can get the Prozac into Charlie. So I got him on it for 2 days. Now it's been 3 days. And I'm pretty sure that, like, you know, I feel like because of the nature of the dynamic I have with the few cats that I have, there's a community there, and some part of me feels like I just lobotomized McMurphy. It's just ridiculous. You know, and I have this conversation with Kit. I'm like, well, you know, I don't want to lose him or change him, even though cats change. And even though this is an issue that I don't want to deal with anymore, but I wasn't really thinking of the cat. You know, Kit was like, look, you know, he's not happy when he's shitting everywhere and peeing out of the box or throwing up or beating up on the other cats. It's not, you know, you're providing a happier life for him. And I just, you know, I still couldn't wrap my brain around it. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that some part of me is sort of like, hey, you know, I mean, diarrhea literally everywhere in the house. In some surprising places, I just found some diarrhea, dried diarrhea, on top of the bookshelf where Charlie sometimes kind of goes if he's scared or Kip brings the bull terrier over. So I've come around to it, but today I went through, like, I was like, is he fucked up already? Is he, like, he seems lethargic? He seems like he's not happy. I don't know what to do. And I called the vet, and I wanted to know exactly what happens to cats on Prozac. It's a lot of energy, and I think it's probably the best thing for him, at least to try it, since I'm going to be away a bit. And maybe he'll be more comfortable when I'm away. Maybe he won't. I mean, Buster is hissing at Charlie for days now. I don't even know what the fuck happened in this house when I left this last time. But there was a major battle. I'm thinking, am I doing Buster's bidding? Is Charlie the rightful alpha of this small crew? And now, like, you know, I've diminished his ability to focus on being that. And Buster, I'm just keeping Buster king, which isn't bad, I guess. But it does, you know, it's like, what am I taking away from Charlie? See, I'm still spiraling about it. It's stupid. Also, I mentioned, well, it must be a week or so that I'm taking this this medicine now, Buspirone, something like that. But it's I decided I was done with the anxiety of panic and my brain choosing to spiral sometimes for days about things that aren't real. They're possible, but they're not real. And it's a manifestation of intrusive thought, obsessional anxiety, whatever. But I decided to try the medicine. And it's been a week or so, and I think something's happening. And it's surprising what's happening, because it gives me more confidence in the decision to take it. Like, it's one thing when you have, you know, cognitive problems like I do. Like, I know what's happening in my brain, and I know when it's happening. And I can make a choice to try to stop it, you know, in a cognitive way. You know, whatever it is, meditation or exercise or trying to stop the noise in the head or get present. Whatever, you know, the cognitive tools are for stopping these patterns of thought that I am conscious of happening. But something seems to be happening on a deeper level, which I find interesting. And I got to talk to the shrink about it when I go back there to check in. But I've noticed, and I don't know if it's possible, I've noticed that I'm breathing better. Now, I don't know where you hold your anxiety or stress or panic, but my chest tightens up always has. And all of a sudden, I've noticed that I'm breathing better, and also I'm sleeping better and deeper. And also, according to my Whoop watch, my recovery has been better than usual, which means less stress. So I think that this medicine is operating at a deep level on that part of my brain that is, you know, constantly in a certain amount of fight or flight, a certain amount of panic. And I hope that's true. I don't know what other people's experience are with this medicine, Buspirone. But it seems to be that what I'm noticing before anything else is something at a level that is, you know, I cannot change cognitively, deeper. And it's having real effects on my body in the way of breathing easier and in the way of better recovery, because apparently I'm not sleeping as stressfully, or I'm not as stressed in general doing just life stuff. So that is positive. Also, and this is where you can chime in, because somebody hit me to, I was talking about walnut oil. And it's pretty common that people who listen to this show, they'll chime in. And some guy was going at it with on the email about pecan oil. He's got this place, Oliver Farms or something. I'm not sure. I should know better. But it's, I think the word Oliver's in it. But they do all the oils. They do all these cold press oils. They got pecan oil. They got pumpkin oil. They got okra seed oil. They got linseed, I think. But the pecan oil, because he said pecans are better even than walnuts in terms of the omegas and the health benefits. So I'm like, I'm turning into this oil weirdo. It's not snake oil. It's nut oil. I'm not even saying it's anything other than what it is. And, you know, I'm hoping for the best, but I've become like kind of a nut oil proponent. I got no grift. I'm not making any money on the back end of this. And I'm not trying to sell you any sort of health hokum. But I did buy some pecan oil and some pumpkin seed oil and some okra seed oil. And the only reason I got the okra seed oil was because this guy that sometimes drives me to the airport, Tom, he's an old Armenian guy. He had heard that okra seeds bring your cholesterol down. I don't even know it's true. I can't even find any research on it. But I'm like, well, fuck it. I'll get some okra oil. But now when I make a smoothie, it's a teaspoon of the pecan oil, teaspoon of the walnut oil, and a teaspoon of the pumpkin seed oil. Because those are the ones, man. So now, I don't know. Yeah, again, all I know is that since I've been vegan, and I'd like to credit the oils with the lack of inflammation in my arthritic toes. And again, I'm not trying to pitch anything to you, but I would like some feedback. Huh? Anyone got any word on the street about okra seeds? Huh? What do you know? Tell me the pros and cons of the pumpkin oil, pumpkin seed oil. What do you got? Pecan oil. What do you know? I mean, I started with walnut oil, but now I'm going oil fucking nuts on nut oil. Yeah, it's happening. Okay, so Lynn Margulies, the documentary she appears in, thank you very much, about Andy Kaufman, her late boyfriend, she was with him the last couple of years of his life, is now playing in theaters and is available to watch on digital on-demand platforms. You can go to thankyouverymuch.drafthousefilms.com for more details. And this is me talking to Lynn Margulies. So you live in New York still?
No, I live up on the Oregon coast.
Oh, really?
I'm from here.
Yeah. When did you run away to Oregon?
That was my most recent running away. I grew up in San Fernando.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you had to get away pretty...
I got away early and then came back, then went away, then came back. I lived in San Francisco for 15 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Where at?
First, I started in Noe Valley.
Yeah, that's
you know
nice.
Noe Valley?
Yeah, I lived there for a couple years.
I lived on 24th Street above the Wells Fargo.
Okay, yeah. What years were that?
That was when Andy was alive.
It was.
So that was 80. I went up in 81, 82, 83. Yeah.
But so what's it, because like, when you watch this documentary, you think it does the job?
It does. Because you know what? including me, because I'm a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Everyone who made something about Andy, just, it was his performances.
Yeah.
Like one performance after another. And, but what Alex wanted to do when I met him, I could just tell, he wanted to figure out what was underneath it all.
Yeah, I think that's, this is the first time that's happened.
It's the first time.
And I think because, you know, I've talked to Bob.
I know, I re-listened to that.
It's crazy.
Oh, what a storyteller, eh?
Yeah, well, I mean, but the problem is like, I think one of the issues with Andy, especially with Zamuda as the guy in charge of the myth and the legacy.
And me.
Yes.
But him more
no,
so.
No, but I mean, but he like was public facing all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was doing it on purpose. I mean, there were points where like it was, it, you know, your place in this doc and in terms of the legacy was the human thing.
Right.
And Zamuda, you know, for I think most of his life, you know, after Andy died, was concerned with continuing the myth. And at the end, there's
exactly.
a little suggestion of that. But, you know, when you talk to Zamuda, it's tall tales.
Right.
With cryptic endings, you know, that suggest something. And I know, though he won't cop to it, that, you know, he was doing Clifton after long after Andy died. And everyone knew that. But Bob was like, no one, you know, whatever. You know,
well, then, yeah, there's Clifton and there's Clifton.
Yeah. And Clifton's, you know, he's He can be inhabited by whoever wants to inhabit Clifton.
And I was going to say, when someone does Clifton, they change. Like,
of course.
Like Jim Carrey.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was great.
I was on the film the
yeah.
whole time.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, you become Clifton and you do stuff you would never do.
Right. Well, yeah, because you have freedom.
You have total freedom.
Yeah.
Oh, but, boy.
But I thought this doc, in terms of answering certain questions and making and suggesting certain things that were kind of investigative, you know, on behalf
of
Alex, the director, in terms of making those connections, you know, around the death of Andy's grandfather and then the impact of the Maharishi. I mean, that's the whole core of the thing on some level. But I mean, whatever Andy did with it, he did with it.
Yeah.
But I guess in terms of you, there seems to be a responsibility on behalf of the people that love the guy to sort of make sure the legacy stays alive.
Well, he actually made us promise, me and Bob both.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, he actually did. Bob says that Andy made him promise to keep Clifton alive, and that's true. And what Andy made me promise, because we were working on I'm From Hollywood at the time, which is that documentary.
Yeah.
He made me promise to finish it, and then he said I had to promise him that I would get his work out into the world.
But this is before he was sick.
This is when he was sick.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the I'm From Hollywood, that's the Fred Blassie one?
No, that's My Breakfast with Blassie.
Right.
I'm From Hollywood is about his wrestling in Memphis.
Oh, right.
Oh, you should see it. It's funny.
I think I have seen
it. It's funny.
Yeah, I mean, I found him funnier. As I get older, I find him more funny.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, because I'm kind of a straight stand-up, you know. And
when you're in the midst of it, you're like...
Well, there's the Kaufman School, and then there's the other school. And he's singular. So anybody who is, you know, playing around in that area, you know, you're always going to get like, oh, he's doing an Andy Kaufman thing.
You
know, and there are guys who do the Andy Kaufman thing.
Now, yeah.
Well, there were. I mean, I knew guys that were so influenced by him, like Dave Cross early on, and there were other cats that were doing the kind of, is this real, is this is this not real? But when you, and I'm glad that Laurie Anderson was in there, because I talked to her, and she told me that about her relationship with Andy, and I didn't think it was a known thing, but I guess she
has. It wasn't, really.
But that song they played, is that an existing song?
Which song is
she,
it?
Behind Andy, she does one of her Laurie Anderson. It's in the...
Oh, yeah, and she mentions Andy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an existing song.
Yeah.
I heard that back in the 90s.
Oh, so that was... So it was always kind of there. It was such an odd connection.
Yeah.
Him connected to... You know, and it makes perfect sense.
It's before either of them were famous.
Well, yeah, but it would have been... He knew that he was doing something that transcended stand-up early on. That it was more of a... I don't know how he would have framed it.
He didn't think that way.
Right. But he was in comedy clubs. So he
was, because that's the only place he could do that stuff.
Yeah.
Where else would he do it? Out on the streets, which he did.
Right. But. Or in performance art spaces.
Right.
Down the Lower East Side.
Right.
So how old were you when you met him?
Oh, God, I was a baby. I was 27 when he died. And, we were just together for 2 years.
Right.
I met him in 82, right after he got the neck brace. Breakfast with Blassie was shot just after the David Letterman show,
yeah,
where he got slapped.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And
I was in Breakfast with Blassie. I'm the one that
right. You talked
meets.
To him. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you were working on that set, or what was it?
My brother is Johnny Legend, who directed it.
Okay.
And I was living up in the mountains of Northern California. I mean, I didn't know who Andy was. I didn't have a TV.
Really?
Nothing.
Well, what was that about?
Living up there?
Yeah.
I'm just not an L.A. girl, you know? I'm not an L.A. girl, so the
But the decision to not have a TV and to, you know.
I just didn't care. I just didn't care.
How about now?
I watch TV now. Yeah, yeah. We like to binge watch shows. But to my own, left to my own devices, I wouldn't watch TV that much, I don't
yeah,
think.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get it. And so you're on this set, and you're just taken with this guy?
Well, no, what happened is they put us in an empty room.
Yeah.
And so we, myself, Linda Letrec, who was the co-producer, her sister, and Andy's assistant, Linda.
Yeah.
They just put us behind them.
Yeah.
At the table behind them. And they said, just eat. Just eat.
Right, right. Background.
And then I got sucked in. They sucked me in, you know,
yeah.
to the scene. And I didn't know who Andy was.
Yeah.
I knew Fred. I've known Fred since I was six.
How come?
Because my brother used to take me to the Olympic Auditorium with him when I was 6 years old.
To watch the wrestling?
Yeah. So Freddie I'd known almost all my life. But who's Andy? I don't know who Andy Kaufman is, you know.
What is it about? You know, it's interesting because the wrestling thing. I think the documentary is very good because it allows you to assess the full arc of what he was up to, you know, in all its forms. But then ultimately, the wrestling, you know, especially since, you know, what the country's become was really, you know, a fairly astute and intuitive you know, reaction or trying to understand you know, the culture we live in.
You know, everyone wants to assign stuff like that to Andy. He just loved wrestling. I mean, period. He just loved wrestling. He loved the bad guy, good guy stuff.
Sure, and right. But for him to evolve, to kind of land there as his, you know, almost his last major work, right? It has, you know, you can't remove him from the culture, right?
No, you can't. But he wasn't thinking of that.
I know. He just
when at the end of his career, when no one would hire him anymore because of all of his shenanigans, he said, "Well, maybe I'll just be a wrestling manager now." I mean,
he just loved wrestling.
Yeah, he loved. I mean, and if you think about it. Everything he did was wrestling, his entire career. It was like, you're one thing, then you're another. You're a good guy, then you're a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
Throw everyone for a loop. And everything, if you look at all of his stuff he did, it's all wrestling.
Yeah. And I also like the idea of any reaction.
Any reaction was good.
Good reaction.
Oh, he loved it. The madder people got at him, the happier he was.
Well, that's a very unique person.
I know.
To
not care.
To not care, but on another level, to, you know, embrace any kind of attention.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a not caring to it, but when people are mad at you, it's almost a more focused and more intense attention than if they like you.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
They are really focused on you.
Totally.
Yeah. And he just soaked it up. He loved it.
Yeah, we have a president like that now.
Oh, God.
I don't know what you do with people like that when they're evil intended, when they want any kind of attention.
I know. Have you seen back the first time Trump was in office, someone put out a picture of him unzipping himself and Andy was stepping out.
Oh, God. that's pretty smart.
Yeah.
I wish that were
the
case.
That was the first time.
Isn't that so? What does Andy represent? That's interesting. You know what Andy represents to people. But your experience with him, you know, like after you met him. I mean, do you feel like there's this idea of in the doc that's kind of kicked around a bit the real Andy?
Yeah.
Do you feel like you saw that?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. Andy, when he wasn't doing stuff, which he was a lot, you know, like
doing
just
stuff.
At home.
He was doing stuff at home, at the restaurant?
No, not at the restaurant, but out in public, on the streets. He would suddenly start doing stuff. He'd start strangling me, you know, stuff like that. But at home, he was just a quiet, just normal, intelligent, quiet person.
Funny?
Not really. No. I mean, He never told jokes or anything.
Yeah.
He was not funny. He wasn't a guy.
Like, quick-witted or anything?
No, he was just really intelligent.
Uh-huh.
Highly intelligent.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And so that's kind of interesting. So the entire thing had to be a show.
Yeah.
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 And when you guys started doing, so I guess as a 27-year-old, you're just excited to be
25.
And he was how old?
He was, I think, 8 years older than me.
Yeah.
7 years older than me.
So it was probably just kind of weird fun.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing, is I was very like him. I could give a shit about famous people.
Yeah.
I didn't care.
Yeah.
It's just he and I were really alike, and I was just floating through life.
Yeah.
I had no ambitions. I didn't want to be an actress. I didn't want to be this. I didn't want to be that.
Did you grow up in show business?
No, but my brother was Johnny Legend.
Yeah.
My dad was a doctor. My mom was a nurse.
Out
in the valley in San Fernando.
Yeah.
And Orange Grove Avenue.
Yeah.
And so I was just floating along. I wasn't, and so it was perfect.
But what was when were you born?
57.
So you were here, like, I mean, Hollywood in the 70s was crazy.
I guess so.
But I mean, going out, what was the vibe? So you met Andy in the 80s, right?
I met him in 82, yeah.
Yeah.
In the 70s, yeah, we used to go to Hollywood Boulevard and hang out and stuff.
Pretty crazy?
Yeah.
Dirty and weird?
Yeah. And crowded.
Yeah.
I mean, Hollywood Boulevard was nuts on the weekends.
Yeah. So when you guys, what was Andy doing when you met him performance-wise?
He was still doing Taxi.
Oh, he was?
Yep. He was still on Taxi.
But it was tense. Or wasn't
it?
It
was always tense. Yeah, I remember one time we were sitting in his, we were meditating in his dressing room. And they were out there rehearsing. And what's his name?
DeVito?
No. The guy who's in my film. I'm getting
Hirsch.
Old and I lose things.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Yeah.
I have a lacuna brain now. Mm-hmm. The boxer.
Oh, Danza.
Yeah, he was pounding on the door.
Yeah.
Andy, get your ass out here. Get it. And I open my eyes, and Andy's just sitting there with his little smile on his face, you know.
What a difficult thing for everybody.
Oh, I know. They all hate, I mean.
I know. When
Danny
I,
didn't hate him, but.
No.
And Mary Lou.
When I watched the doc, I realized, like, Judd's got to hate this guy still.
Judd hated him.
This guy still hated him.
Yeah.
And he's like 90-something.
Yeah, yeah.
I worked with him.
Judd hated him. I know. I watched your show.
Yeah.
I saw it.
Oh, good. Yeah. But it's a lot to deal with. And Andy just didn't.
He didn't care.
But do you think that on some level, did he lack empathy?
Yes.
Yeah.
He did. Except for certain things. Like, I know there was like people he would visit in the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he would go visit, you know, people in the hospital every now and again.
Random
someone
people?
Someone he knew.
Oh,
no.
So.
People he knew.
Yeah.
Like some woman was in the hospital and he'd go visit her when he was in town.
Yeah.
But no, he really didn't. He was in his own. It was Andy's world.
Yeah,
it
right.
was his world.
Well, it's fortunate he was talented.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Who knows what would have happened to him if he wasn't.
Well, when you were with him, did you guys, because there's a lot of stuff he talks about that I didn't know, you know, tracking his life. You know, this idea that hadn't he found TM,
mm-hmm. he would have been a drug addict.
Yeah. Do you think that's true?
He said it was.
Yeah.
I mean, he said it over and over again that he was living in a park and he was doing drugs and he was drinking. And then TM saved him.
That footage of him asking the Maharishi that question, who the hell had that? That was how did he find
TM, that? The TM archives.
They did.
They actually went to, you know, Lauren. Lauren got it all done.
That is
Lauren
crazy.
Lauren Belfer. Yeah. I know.
It's a crazy moment where, you know, his question is so specific. And at that time, he knew that somehow or another comedy was the answer for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, the question about the nature of comedy and that Maharishi answered it with this idea of, I can't remember exactly what he said, something about silence, right?
Something about silence, yeah. It's all comes down to silence.
And then you have this realization. It's the same with David Lynch in a way, that they create a zone of experience that is not really easily or able to be processed
right.
by an audience.
By normal humans.
Yeah. And you're suspended in it.
Yeah, yeah. I love that.
Well, that kind of blew my mind. That they create, it's not a meditative state, but it is a altered perception.
Yes.
And it's happening in the moment.
Yes.
And that's kind of crazy.
I know. Andy, at the end of his life, they had cards printed up. He was going to do a tour called On Creating Reality.
Huh. Do you know what was about?
I think he was going to fill it with a lot of mumbo jumbo.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
Because all of us, everyone out in the world, are all trying to put a name to what he did, put a reason to what he did, and like figure out what he did.
Yeah.
And he just laughed at that because he just did what he did because it was fun.
Right.
So he was going to do this tour called On Creating Reality.
Well, it's an interesting thing about a person who... You know, I've only met a few that they get this idea in their head, and you know, no matter whether it makes sense or not, you know, there's something about the, you know, conjuring it that the will to commit to it is crazy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, why?
And then the will to see it through.
Yeah. Like, why?
Why?
And then they, but
and course, everyone wants to figure out why.
Well, that's like, but I guess that's the nature of a real artist, right?
I guess
you don't answer the questions.
No. But a lot of them do.
Yeah.
That's the thing. A lot of them do, especially if they do stuff like Andy did. They can't stand the backlash. They have to let on, you know. Doesn't everyone, like, finally explain what they're doing or why they're doing it?
I guess so, but how are you even going to explain from the beginning? How are you going to explain, you know, the Mighty Mouse thing? How are you going to explain that?
You can't.
No, you can't.
Because
you're just
doing it.
Right. You can explain Foreign Guy.
And why is it funny?
Well, I think that's the real genius part, is that it is still a commitment to comedy.
Right.
And you still get to a point where you're like, holy shit, you're laughing.
Yeah.
Because it's crazy.
He thought of himself more as vaudeville.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, not comedy. He never thought of himself having to do with comedy. It was vaudeville.
So you're with him when he gets fired or when Taxi ends?
Yeah, yeah.
He must have seen it coming. Or no, I guess not. It had nothing to do with him that the show was stopped.
Yeah, he was relieved.
Yeah.
He really hated doing Taxi.
Because he was stuck.
He felt like it was sold out Foreign Man and, you know, made it commercial. But on the other hand... It made him money, and it made him able to do all the other things he did because he was famous.
Right.
So he could do all these things and be on shows and, you know, do stuff in the streets and stuff because he was famous because of Taxi.
And this is before the Jerry's Deli or after? It's after he worked at Jerry's, right?
Jerry's was during Taxi.
Yeah. You weren't with him, though.
No. No, yeah, he wasn't doing that then.
I kind of remember that being a thing. Like, when, you know, coming out here, I was in New York, and, you know,
there's
like
this guy working at
Coffin's working at Jerry's. And I'm like, that's crazy.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Oh. And so what happens after Taxi ends with you guys?
That's when it started being, well, he was still on Letterman, but
Letterman, I think, liked him.
Letterman loved him. Letterman loved Andy. At the time, I think Andy had been the guest more times than anyone else.
The period where he brought the adopted kids on?
Yes. And
were
I was
there?
With, yeah, yeah. In fact, we met them at Times Square. We went to Times Square and
they were just guys on the street?
They were at an arcade playing games.
Uh-huh.
And Andy just started talking to him. I mean, and said, hey, you want to be on Letterman with me?
And they didn't really know him, or one of them did.
They might have known who he was.
So he literally found those guys in Times Square and then walked up to the studio with them.
Not that day.
Not that
day. No, he got, you know, he got their phone numbers and stuff and then got them together to go on Letterman and say they were his adopted sons.
It's a crazy moment where Letterman's just stuck with them out in the studio.
I know.
And trying to have a guest conversation.
I know.
And you were backstage for that?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, like, the Elvis bit must have been planned, right?
Was that show?
Yeah, where one of the kids says, like, you did Elvis or something.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, because, and then he chose to come out with the bad wig and the jacket that's
and
not
do it
Elvis.
Badly.
And just do Elvis in that jacket.
Right. Do it badly. Yeah, that was like, he told one of the kids to say that.
Yeah, yeah. And at what point, I mean... I'm trying to figure out what public perception was of him at that time.
It was pretty bad.
Because he'd been thrown out of SNL.
And he'd done all the wrestling. And you
that
know
was that, already done, the wrestling.
Yeah.
It was all done.
Yeah. He'd done, well, the wrestling women. He was still wrestling in Memphis. No one knew he was doing the wrestling in Memphis because if you think about it, cable wasn't big at that time. So.
And wrestling's all over the place.
Now, but not back then. No
yeah, it was
one knew.
Regional.
No one knew he was going to Memphis and doing all the wrestling.
Guys?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's just being a wrestler.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where he pissed off, what's his name, Lawler.
Lawler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
but,
wasn't about the woman. That was about him calling out, being a heel and calling Lawler out.
Right. But after the neck brace thing, after the he kept going back because he wanted to get revenge. And that's what no one knew about. That's what's in I'm From Hollywood is him going back to get revenge
on Lawler.
On Lawler. And he went over and over and over and over again. And back to Memphis.
That was the when he hurt his neck, that's when Lawler dropped him.
Yeah,
right?
That was in April 5th of 1982.
Did he really hurt his neck?
Sort of. Not as bad. You know, he didn't need to keep wearing that neck brace till it was like filthy and falling apart.
But he was committed to the heel.
He was committed to it, yeah.
And this was his career. Was he making money?
No.
No.
He never cashed. They did pay him, but he never cashed a single check.
From the wrestling.
Yeah. He just went. So that's what was going on all through 83, basically, was him going to Memphis and wrestling.
Uh-huh. So what do you make of it?
What do I make of it?
I mean, because, like, I know that, you know, you can say that he was just having a good time, but I don't think he was.
He was. Oh, he absolutely was.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He wouldn't have done it. It was fun. He was just having fun.
So he had no, I guess what's interesting, hard for me to wrap my brain around was that there, the element that most people call like self-sabotage,
yes.
Right, is when you fuck your career up.
Right, like he did.
Right. But, you know, and that's usually attributed to people that aren't quite aware of it or have no control over that.
Right.
But it seems to me that out of his, you know, boredom and anger.
You're putting that on him.
Well, no, to Taxi.
Oh, Taxi. Yeah.
Yeah, that the idea would be to blow it up. And he couldn't seem to do it while he was there, even though he tried in so many ways. Almost, it seems like he was trying to get fired. He was defying them.
Well, there was that one time Tony got fired.
Right.
Yeah.
But the character was so popular, they couldn't
they
let
couldn't
it go.
They couldn't let it go, yeah.
And they just
couldn't. Yeah, they couldn't get rid of him.
He was holding them hostage.
He was, actually. Yeah. They couldn't get rid of him. He was the most popular person on the show, I think. Yeah.
Oh, my God. The whole thing is like an art piece, but, you know, he's not going to cop to that.
But he wasn't doing it.
No,
as
I know, I know. But like know? When you look at when you
when
assess
we look
it,
at it,
right?
When we look at it,
the implications
now.
Of it in terms of show business, in terms of all that stuff.
Exactly.
He turns it on its head by creating
completely.
His own reality.
And then on all the other shows, like on Fridays when he got in the fight with Michael Richards.
Oh, when he goes and gets the cue cards.
Well, he throws the water on him, and then Letterman where he gets slapped. Yeah. Oops, sorry. And what's the other one he screwed up? There was another one. I can't remember. But anyway, he was just, and you would think he was doing it on purpose to sabotage his career, but he was just doing wrestling.
Yeah. Well, I think like, for me, like that Carnegie Hall concert is the best thing
ever.
Oh,
it's amazing, isn't it?
It's the best thing ever. And even in the doc, they don't let on that woman may or may not have died.
That was perfect.
It
they
was
did
so
it so well.
Perfect. But that in the doc, that is the one thing that they don't reveal.
Right.
Because Zamuda says, yeah, he died, you know.
Yeah. She really did die.
Yeah. Yeah, like, out of all the things in the dock that they're going to keep a mystery, it's that poor lady on that little riding horse.
Well, you want to stay true to Andy's.
Right?
Yeah. But he let her come back up with, you know, he put on the Indian feathers and came out, whoa, 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 and she came back to life.
That's right. Yeah. So I guess, did the woman really die?
No.
Not on stage. But no. Yeah.
It was all a bit.
Yeah. So now he's just doing the wrestling and you're not going to Memphis with him?
Oh, yeah. I always went.
You did?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what was the vibe? They just hated
they
him?
They hated him. In fact, he would stay in his dressing room till everyone was gone and I would have to go out and make sure Lawler had left, for one thing. I'd have to see Lawler get in his car and drive away before Andy would come out of his dressing room.
Because he was afraid of him?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get the sense that, that Lawler would really beat him up?
No.
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 He was a pro, right?
Andy was just, you know.
Doing
his thing.
Being dramatic.
Being dramatic.
So what's the arc of it? How long does that go on for?
Goes on until Andy got cancer at the end of 83.
Huh.
You know, he kept going back. In fact, I there's some video when he's coughing, you know, and I'm like, yeah. Oh my God, you can see him coughing.
Yeah. And does he see the doctor down there or he comes
No,
back?
LA in December.
He comes to
83.
Because the cough had gotten too much and
yeah, he went in for his cough to see why he was coughing all the time.
Mm. So sad.
I know. And then he got cancer. And then what he wanted to do was go on Letterman and say he got cancer for Christmas.
Yeah. And that didn't happen?
I don't know why that didn't happen. He even got a phone line put in his apartment and had his name on it in the phone book so people could call him.
Really?
Because he was going to go on Letterman and announce his phone number and say he got cancer for Christmas. Yeah.
And then then see what the calls came in?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder what that was. What do you make of that? You wanted some love?
No, it was just fun.
Oh, come on.
I swear to God, it was just, I mean, he didn't think these through like everyone else does.
No,
he just thought it would be cool.
I know, but we can read them now.
I know.
Some of them.
I know.
And that seems like.
Seems like it, doesn't it?
That he wanted some sort of caring.
He just thought it would be funny to announce his phone number on David Letterman and then have it actually be a real phone that
and
you could
just
call.
Deal with it.
Yeah, well, he had a machine hooked up to it. I don't know if he was ever actually going to answer it. Yeah, he got one call that someone actually found his number and called.
Just out of curiosity.
Just out of curiosity, yeah.
But what do you, like, in the relationship, I know that in the doc, it says, you know, he has a couple of women saying that he was not. What's also interesting is, you know, some of the women that have known him his whole life's reaction to the wrestling.
Yeah.
There was a line that he crossed with a lot of people.
Including his family. They hated it.
They did?
Oh, yeah. They hated it. They wanted nice Andy. Mm. You know, they wanted foreign man.
Mm-hmm.
They were not happy with all the wrestling and all the stuff he was doing.
I like that they found a real foreign man.
Isn't that amazing?
Is that from old footage?
No. That's brand new.
Because some of it is kind of old,
yeah.
Obviously. But
yeah.
Some of it's new. Like Steve Martin was new.
Martin's new. Danny DeVito.
Yep.
Me, of course,
and
his friends, but you know, like is Robin
Robin's
Williams?
In it.
Yeah, that's all from Comic Relief Archives.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you do have this desire somehow to interpret and pathologize,
mm-hmm.
Right? And
people do. I don't.
Well, it doesn't.
That's why Andy and I got along so well because I didn't.
It doesn't matter in the big picture, but in order to critically, sort of assess his legacy, it's fun to.
And I'm he sure, would love that people are doing that.
Sure.
Like he would love it.
I'm sure there have been books written or essays written or the implications of, you know, the wrestling period. You would hope.
Yes.
You would hope. But in terms of his personal relationships, there was a couple of women saying that he just was not capable of any sort of intimacy.
No, not really. Not even with me.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't. He would do it like I would go over and make him put his arm around me and I'd lean on him. He'd go, oh, they're there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know,
oh, really?
Aw. Yeah, like he was pretending. Yeah.
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 Yeah, because like, you know, as somebody who has my own issues with intimacy, I just like trying to track why that where that comes from is kind of interesting.
That is interesting.
And I have to assume it's still that injury from the grandfather. That how could he trust anybody?
That and his dad, I think, you know, Bob and I have talked about this. His dad was, I think he probably had PTSD from World War II and he yelled a lot.
Oh, really?
And I think that's what drove Andy into his room.
And also, I imagine what drove him to, you know, seek the love of the grandfather as much as possible.
Yeah.
Because to have that a relationship with your grandfather is a big deal.
Exactly.
And if your dad's running around yelling all the time, so it's chaos.
And I think.
And it's frightening.
And I think that's maybe why he liked wrestling too so much is because the bad guys were an act. It wasn't real.
So
whereas in
his
life, it was real, but in wrestling, it wasn't real.
You could disarm it and live in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the relationship wasn't particularly intimate in that way where he's able to trust or open his heart that much.
I would think so. Yeah. Probably. Yeah. Yeah.
So what happens after the diagnosis? How does the life change?
Well, God, it happened so fast. You know, he was diagnosed in December and he died in May. And so it was just going to the doctors. They talked him into doing radiation, which he didn't want to do. And then some friend of his told him about the faith healers in the Philippines. And Andy just went, okay, that sounds good. And off we went to the Philippines for 6 weeks to see the faith healers there.
Did you get a sense that he wanted it to, he believed it?
Yeah. Yeah. He believed, he was kind of magical thinking, you know? It's like he never thought cancer would kill him. Mm. He just said, oh, I've got cancer now, I'll have to get rid of it, basically was his.
So he couldn't really wrap his brain around.
Dying.
I guess you have to have some magical thinking at the beginning, at least.
Yeah.
I guess you go through those five stages alive, you know?
Really fast.
Yeah.
I don't know what the five stages are, but he never got angry.
Yeah, I think it's denial.
Yeah. Well, denial
anger,
was definitely, yeah.
I think it's denial, depression or anger, and then acceptance at some point.
Yeah, he did accept it towards the end.
He did?
Yeah, although he never would say, I'm dying, but I think he knew he was dying.
Yeah.
You know?
And because I saw that footage in the doc where he went to the improv with the mohawk and stuff. And it was interesting because even, like, you know, Bud Friedman, who's a pretty tough guy, was pretty choked up.
Oh, Bud loved him. And he threw a party after that, after that screening. And that was the last time I ever saw Andy was at that. Because that was like the day or two before we went to the Philippines.
Oh, were the party at the improv?
Yeah, he threw a party for him at the improv, impromptu.
You know,
just said, everyone come to the improv. And
he really loved him, huh?
Oh, he loved Andy like a son. Yeah, yeah.
I like that.
He was really broken up.
Yeah, I like that story because Bud was the first guy that saw him at the original improv.
Yep.
and knew something was totally unique about the guy.
Yeah, I don't know how Bud figured out, because Andy wouldn't have told him.
What
he was going to do. No, at the very beginning, he wouldn't have told him that he was going to do the whole Foreign Man and Elvis and stuff. And
sure.
Bud let him on stage.
Yeah, I think it must have just been like, you know, he believed it. And then when it turned into something else, he said, oh, this is something beyond anything that is out happening now.
Yeah.
And I don't think that Bud was like, this is going to be a huge success or anything, but he knew the guy was touched.
Exactly.
Somehow. Yeah.
And like, that's what Taxi did for him is he got real big, you know. He was on shows before that, but he wasn't well known.
Yeah.
You know, but then he got on Taxi and he was huge.
Yeah, and he's doing I love that the guy who was the inspiration for Foreign Man, who was apparently because he was
Baji.
Yeah, but because he was, you know, from another country and couldn't integrate socially, of course that's Andy's only friend.
Right.
In college. Those
guys. Oh yeah, cuz that's what Andy was like.
Yeah. So, but you know, what's interesting is when the director, whoever was on the camera, and it's a very modern proposition, when the director says, are you mad because he stole that from you? Because that's such a thing with people, like, oh, he took my act.
He took me.
Right.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, no, it's my gift.
Aw, isn't that sweet? It was my gift.
Yeah. It was beautiful because it goes against everything that in capitalist culture. That, you know, bitter people accuse people of.
Right. Anyone else would have been suing Andy for stealing his persona.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that guy was like, you know, he's my friend.
Yeah.
So he had a few friends.
Not many.
Yeah.
Greg Sutton from childhood.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Andy was like me. We're both the same. We're not comfortable with humans, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Who were the guys that hung out towards the end?
Bob.
Just Amuda?
Yeah. I mean.
The management had enough of him.
No, George loved him.
Yeah.
George always loved Andy, no matter what. But,
Andy
knew a lot of people, but he didn't hang out with people.
Right.
I mean, he had me. And I always say the only reason that he and I managed to get together, I think, is because Bob was off doing DC Cab. Then he wrote DC Cab and he was in it. And so Bob was gone and Andy was like left without a friend. And then he met me. and I took Bob's place for a while because...
Yeah.
You know,
and over the arc of the sickness, which was quick, did you did you sense a, like a change in the way he saw his life?
No.
Not really?
No, not at all.
He just took it?
He just accepted, I mean, yeah, he just accepted it. I mean, things happen and that's how it goes, you know?
Yeah.
The only thing he was very disappointed in, what's his name from Saturday Night Live? Not Lorne Michaels, the other guy, the original guy.
Oh, Ebersol.
Ebersol, because he felt that he betrayed him when they kicked him off. They did the vote.
Yeah.
And Andy and Ebersol figured he'd be kicked off. As a joke. But then Andy was supposed to come back, you know. He was supposed to come back in disguise. Like,
right.
Ha, 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 I snuck back in. But Ebersol didn't let him back on.
So
he was really
so
hurt
there
by
was
that.
An agreement and that in the sense that they were still buddies and then he kept him off.
It was all supposed to be an act. He'd get kicked off and then he'd sneak back on.
Mm.
And then Ebersol betrayed him. And he really felt betrayed. I mean, that was the one he was hurt. And he was also hurt by the meditation movement because they wanted to kick him out because of the wrestling.
Right.
They wouldn't let him come on the courses. He used to love to go on the courses they have, and they wouldn't let him. They wouldn't
really?
Let him. Yeah.
Yeah, because I know they mentioned that, and they didn't go too deep into it. But he was very active within the TM community?
Not as much in later years, but he would go to the courses. Okay. And then he signed up for one, and they wouldn't let him do it.
Really?
Yeah, and he was really hurt by that, because TM was his life.
Twice a day?
Oh, God.
No matter what?
No matter what. And he had a long meditation, and he'd fall asleep. And if he fell asleep, he'd start over. So he'd be, like, meditating for, like, 3-4 hours.
Really?
Yes.
So he really got out there.
Yeah, and no matter what, if we were in New York Times Square, we'd go to a movie theater. So he could meditate, or he'd get a hotel room so he could meditate.
Yeah, my
never missed it.
My late girlfriend was like that. She, you know, she was locked into that, you know, and no matter what, if she were on set, she was like, go do the 20
minutes.
I didn't
know she was a meditator.
Lynn? Yeah,
yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
It was like very important, you know, and she had her special chair, and if she was directing, you know, she'd go and do it. And I think it really worked for her.
Yeah.
Like there was something like, you know, when I'm watching that, because I just got on medicine for anxiety after decades.
I've been on it since 2006.
What are you on?
Paxil.
Oh, this one's like a different one.
Yeah.
But when I'm watching that, like there's always that part of your brain that wants to make excuses. I'm like, well, you know what, dude? Just lock in. Just go to the TM thing. Let's fucking resolve this thing.
Yeah.
But then minutes later, I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you have anxiety, it's a medical condition. It's like...
Well, good. Yeah, I'm working on accepting that.
I don't think all the meditation in the world can get rid of... It's like meditating to get rid of your heart disease, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, well, I like that framing.
Yeah.
I'll take it. Because I always tend to think like it's a reasonable reaction.
Yeah. No, it's horrible.
It is horrible.
I hate anxiety.
I live it.
I did too, all my life.
And it's gone?
Completely gone. As long as I stay on my and I've tapered off many times, thinking, okay, I'm fine now.
Right.
Boom, comes right back.
Really?
Yep. So I've just accepted it. You know, I take a pill.
Yeah. Big
I take
deal.
A pill, and I'm not miserable anymore.
So Andy didn't make you anxious?
Not at all. I was having fun.
Oh, so he was like medicine. He was like medicine.
Yeah, but I couldn't. He wanted me to perform with him, but because of my anxiety disorder, I couldn't do anything in public at the time.
Oh, really? What did he want you to do?
First of all, he wanted me. I would say things. He'd go, "Oh, you're funny. You should get up there."
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. And I can't. You know,
to do stand up.
Yeah, he wanted me to do stand-up, and it's like, no, I can't. Or he'd want me, like, he originally wanted me to help him write his Chicago show, and even that, I was too like, me, do
right.
that, you
oh,
know?
Yeah.
So he got Elaine Boozler to come in and do it.
Boozler.
But I was just too anxiety-ridden.
So were you there when he died?
Yep. Yep. Yep.
In the hospital?
Yep. I was holding his foot because his family were up holding his hands. And so Linda Mitchell and I were at the base of the bed, and each holding a foot.
Yeah. Wow. And was it peaceful?
It was. It was.
Were there, you know, last requests?
No. No, he was just tired at the end. He was just tired. You know, he was just sleeping most of the time.
So the discussions about his legacy... Those happened after he was diagnosed?
Yes.
And what was it exactly?
The,
what did he say?
The promises?
Yeah.
Well, one, like I said, we had started I'm From Hollywood.
Yeah.
And that's about his wrestling in Memphis.
And he won that finish.
He, I mean, because that was his, that was the height of his career as far as he was concerned. I mean, that was it, his wrestling.
This is what he was working towards.
Absolutely. So he made me promise to finish it. And boy, was that hard.
Why?
Because I had to work on it right after he died.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It was so hard. But I finished it. And the other thing he made me promise in front of George Shapiro, he said, George, I want Lynn to get everything I ever did out into the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that, he said, promise to help her. And then George kind of conveniently forgot that later when I tried to do it.
Well, what would you try? How would you try to do it?
Well, after I'm From Hollywood, I came to George and I said, okay, now I'm ready to do the rest of this stuff.
Which, in your mind, what was that? How will you do it?
Oh, just like find everything he ever did and either put it out as a compilation,
yeah.
Maybe do a movie
right.
of all of his work,
right.
you know?
Yeah.
And George just kind of said, well, I helped you do I'm From Hollywood. That's enough. And
oh, really?
Kind of like,
that was it.
That was it.
Well, thank God for YouTube. Now.
Well, then what I did was I took every, I used to sell the stuff on DVDs that I just made,
put
made.
Together? Yeah.
Yeah, I sold them on eBay because Andy asked me to do it. And so I was putting the stuff out
like
there.
Like what?
I did two DVDs that I called the Kaufman Archives.
Yeah.
And I just put clips from all his different shows on them.
And personal interview pieces?
Nope, just shows.
They sell?
Yeah, I mean, you know, $20 a piece. And,
yeah.
You know.
You still got some?
I found a couple. Yeah,
really?
They're so cute because I typed up a thing about all of them and I signed it and I put that inside the DVD case, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
It's really sweet.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that it's taken this long for someone to do a real assessment.
I know.
Because there hasn't been a documentary, has there really?
No, there have been, like Bob and I did an A&E biography on him.
Right.
And a couple people have just done little private things
yeah.
that they've put out. But
yeah.
no, this is the first one, the first documentary that actually delves into who he was and why he did it. Rather than just present like his performances.
Yeah.
It actually delves into...
Yeah, I was amazed at the connections that the filmmaker made. It was pretty smart.
It was.
Smart guy.
That's why he spent so much time with me.
Yeah. He needed to know what you knew because you were there at the height of
and
his
Bob,
career.
And yeah.
But if you believe, and Andy believed, that the wrestling was really...
The epitome, the height,
yeah,
the apex was, of on, his so, career.
So on some level... According to him, that was the most important time.
Absolutely.
And you
absolutely.
Were there for that.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
But what about the estate? I mean, how do people just churn out this material? I mean, like, you know, because usually it's protected, right?
Oh, well, yeah, now it is. His father wasn't as yeah, see, I went through all these years thinking, well, I promised Andy I would do this.
Yeah.
And that's why I was putting stuff out,
yeah.
putting stuff out. And then his dad died. And his brother took over, and his brother has put the kibosh on everyone doing stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So the family did have the estate, but the father didn't give a shit.
Yeah, his father didn't.
Didn't see any point. So now.
And back then, it wasn't, no one was really putting stuff out, you know?
Or maybe not necessarily protecting it or, you know, or didn't see the, why anyone would care necessarily.
Exactly. That's his kind of. Yeah. Back when Andy had all of his stuff, after Taxi ended, he moved out of his house in the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah.
And he put all his stuff in storage.
Uh-huh.
And after he died, his dad just called Linda Mitchell, his assistant, and said, get rid of everything. So Linda called me and I said, send it to my mom's garage. You know?
Yeah. Oh, really?
I had her send it all to me. Yeah. Because his dad
From
was just like, get rid of it. You know?
That's crazy. Well, that's what people do. After people die, you know, like one, you know, usually there's a sensitivity to it. Somebody
right.
goes through it.
Right.
And takes what they hold dear. But a lot of it is just sort of like, I don't know.
Well, his dad has still had all the stuff in Andy's childhood room at the house.
Awesome.
That was all still there.
And that's interesting.
I know.
It?
They just left his room.
Yeah.
We used to go stay in it when we were there.
Really?
Little twin bed.
Really?
Yeah.
They kept it just intact.
Well, it was his room, and he would come back and stay there.
With all the childhood stuff in it?
Yeah, just all his stuff. Yeah.
That's so wild. I thought that that was an interesting part of, like, I didn't love the movie, you know, the
Man
Jim
on the Moon.
Yeah. Because, you know, I like Milosh's work. And
I love Milosh.
Yeah, he's great. And I think Jim Carrey did the best he could. But, you know, how are you going to do that?
Yeah. He didn't know Andy.
Yeah. And, you know, even if you study him, how are you going to find that vulnerability that he had?
I said that to the writers, who I'm going to see tomorrow. We've stayed friends. Yeah. That there's nothing cinematic about Andy's life apart from his work.
Right.
Like I said, I don't know what you're going to write about because he was not cinematic.
Yeah, he went out of his way not to be cinematic.
Yeah.
He kind of became a vacuum.
Which, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I would call him, I always called him a vessel. Like,
yeah.
You know, things went in him and came out of him.
Yeah. Yeah, because like there are times I think when you see him where he turns it all off.
Yeah.
And there's, it's a type of vulnerability, but it's almost like
an act.
Yeah. It's an act, but I think he got, I think that there was a real thrill for him in those moments. And I'm speculating that like when he was on stage not getting laughs on purpose, it's different than him actually being himself, you know, like with Letterman for
right.
a minute.
Right.
And like, I think.
Because it's still part of the act.
It's part of the act, but I think the experience of the whoever's watching him or talking to him having anticipation and him having moments of like, I'm actually being me and this is what they're waiting for.
And see, that's the beauty of it. You never know, even if he's being me.
Yeah.
If it's yeah. real. Like I, you know, people will ask me, is he dead? Is he alive?
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what I say because you never know what's real.
Right.
Still, even now.
Yeah. There's a few people that still want to hold on.
Yeah.
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 The one thing in the movie that I thought was kind of smart and well shot was there's a moment in the movie.
Which movie?
The Man on the Moon.
Man on the Moon.
Where the way Milosh shot the Philippine stuff. Where you sense watching the film that Andy knew this was a performance.
He didn't.
But it's in the movie.
It's in the movie. There's a lot in the movie that's not correct.
Yeah. So he didn't.
No, he never. He thought he was healed. I mean, he thought, you know, June LeBeau said, okay, you're healed now. And Landy said, okay. I mean, Andy, he was really savvy and smart, but he had this very naive side too, his childlike naivety.
And the magical thinking.
So he just believed it was all working.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think Forman went out of his way to suggest that.
Right.
And even if it wasn't that Andy knew, you know, the audience.
Bob and I knew.
Right, but it was like, it was something Andy would have done.
Exactly. Exactly. In fact, I almost think, he never said it, but going to the Philippines, I was thinking, I always thought that he thought, well, this is the weirdest thing I can do, get cancer and go to the Philippines.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But the performative element of, it's not unlike wrestling, any sort of crackpot thing.
Yeah.
Wrestling is just the most honest.
Right.
And that must have been why that was his major work, is that you're not going to get more honest than wrestling somehow.
You don't get, yeah, even, exactly, which is fun. Funny,
it is.
Isn't it? It's a funny dichotomy, like that you're totally honest in wrestling.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because everyone knows the game.
They do now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that within that world, you know, the characters, you know, they're you know, it's a hard thing to really explain, but it is the most honest entertainment because it's like, that's the bad guy.
Right.
That's the good guy.
But the bad guy might become a good guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, back in the 60s, it was very different. People believed it. I mean, 60s wrestling was very different.
But even now, like, people don't care.
They don't care.
It's fake.
Yeah.
They're there for the show.
It's great entertainment.
Yeah. It's the spectacle of it.
Yeah.
So when you think about Andy, what do you miss the most?
What do I miss the most about Andy? You know, really just hanging out and having fun.
Yeah.
Because I'm still that way.
Yeah.
I still just want to hang out and have fun.
Yeah.
Go to Disneyland.
Yeah.
I mean, I love just.
Did he go to Disneyland?
We never went to Disneyland together, but he loved going to amusement parks.
He did?
Oh, God. There was an amusement park. We went.
Which part of it?
He would love to, like, get on a ride. Yeah. And then as the ride was coming to a halt, he'd be crying. Like, that was so scary. You know?
In front of everybody?
Yeah. Yeah.
He loved
being a kid. He loved being a little kid. He just wanted to be a little kid.
And he loved fucking with people.
And yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, I love the movie and it was great to talk to you.
Oh, I'm so glad you loved it. Yeah. I love it too.
Oh, good.
It's great to talk to you too.
Yeah, I'm glad you're happy with the film.
Me too.
There You Go, Thank You Very Much is now in theaters and available on digital platforms. Go to thankyouverymuch.drafthousefilms.com for more info. Hang out for a minute. Hey, folks, for more about Andy Kaufman, we put together a WTF collection for Full Marin listeners that's full of Andy stories from the people who knew him. Bob Zmuda, Mary Lou Henner, Carol Kane, Bud Friedman, Danny DeVito, and more.
Andy would be like sitting in his dressing room eating sushi during the day.
Yeah.
And you could go in and talk to him and hang out with him without having to worry about becoming part of his art project.
Right.
Which most of the time you were. You know, like there were a couple times that I was when we first met and when I'd be in the hallway hanging out and he's there and he'd come out of his dressing room and all of a sudden some woman would come in with a package like delivering.
Yeah.
You know, a UPS person or a postal worker.
Right. Yeah.
And he would start on her. And you go, what are you doing? Taking a job away from a man. Okay. You know, you should be in the kitchen. You should be doing blah, blah, blah. And then she'd get pissed off at him. And then we would all come out. I'd be out in the dressing in the hallway. What's going on out here? And they would be rolling up their sleeves and wrestling.
Uh-oh.
And they would get on the ground and they would wrestle. Now, here's the thing about that.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it until many years later. I bought it. And everybody else bought it. But I suspect that that woman was on the payroll. Okay?
Yeah.
That's how fucking crazy Andy was.
Yeah, of course.
She came in dressed in a uniform.
Yeah.
To put on a show.
Right.
Okay, well, maybe I'm a little slow. He did the thing really well, and we all bought it. Like, what are you doing?
A little slow took years.
Took years. Yeah, a little slow.
That's the latest bonus episode available to Full Marin subscribers. To sign up for the Full Marin and get bonus episodes twice a week, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast.
Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda, Cat Angels everywhere. Screwed up at the end.